How you feeling? You were sick last week.
Oh, I'm.
Did you go to the hospital?
I did go to the ER. Are we live? Are we recording?
This is it. This is the show. I think this is what the people want to hear.
Yeah. No. I was just making sure that I had my mic good here. Yeah. I was like super super sick.
What happened?
Well, I do this little charity thing, and I made the mistake of traveling directly before it. And so I came home a little bit sick, and then I did all the promo for the fundraiser. And this year I'm live streaming every day for the fundraiser. And then I do interviews for the fundraiser, and then I did the podcast, and then I live streamed. And I had a cold, and so about like this cold combined with 8 hours of talking on the first day of the fundraiser was not my best.
You gotta get your warm pineapple juice.
I did. Oh, I brought out like every trick in the book.
You gotta denature that sucker.
I denatured myself. I had my herbal like hippie tea. But, and you know, it was, and then, so it wasn't just like, I did like an interview with this website, I did, you know, all this stuff, and then the stream, and plus I have a cold, and so I'm exhausted, I'm running a fever, I'm coughing, you know, my nose is stuffed up, and then, but you know, it's the early days of the fundraiser and I'm live streaming these games. So then I do an extra stream at night, like another 3 hours of me playing a game and talking to kind of give things a bump at the beginning. And then, but the next day I'm streaming another 3 hours and then another 3 hours and plus more interviews. And then I have meetings and my throat, I'd made it really rough on that first day, even though I was doing everything to take care of it, except not use it. Worse and worse until like one night I was coughing and coughing and coughing, and then I coughed and I felt something. It felt really weird in my throat. And have you ever gone in like your hair gets too long, or like really long, or you go in for a really short haircut and then like you go outside and your head feels cold. You're like, oh, the air is touching my ears or something like that.
Let's say for the sake of argument that I have.
Okay. It's more of an issue for me. I get my hair cut like once a year. But, you know, that sensation is what I felt in my throat. Like I breathed in and I could feel parts. I could feel like the air touching parts of my throat that it felt like they had never touched before. And when I coughed, it made this horrible noise and it was super painful. And I go, great. I have now like torn my vocal cord. I was honestly sure. And so I went to the doctor and it turns out it's okay. But like they put me on a bunch of steroids. They gave me codeine and I spent a couple of days just really not talking at all, including last week, you know, when I didn't record the podcast with you.
And what was the verdict? I mean, are you okay?
I am okay. Yeah. As you can tell, the Sea Witch does not have my voice. And, The verdict is I was a little freaked out and paranoid. It is virtually impossible to tear a vocal cord through merely coughing. It's likely that I strained it, or you can sprain a vocal cord. But the big thing is that I had just been abusing myself, and that made me fucking rein it in a little bit.
Well, you finally did it. You like had like a physical collapse from working too hard. Congratulations.
Exactly. It was not.
Who would have guessed it would be you who went first between the two of us?
We should have had a pool going.
Guess what this is? I don't know if you can hear this.
What is that?
This is a book. I purchased this book at a Noble in Western Illinois that I had to stop at because I was charging my electric vehicle at a mall. And
I was wondering what the hell you were doing in a real bookstore.
I had no other options, and you know, I figured that they would have a Starbucks. And the fantasy shelf at this Barnes & Noble was a sorry state. And I was like, I'm in the mood for like a fantasy book. I will text Pat and see what he recommends. And they did not have, you know, an awesome selection. But guess what they did have?
What's that?
The unicorn lived in a lilac wood, and she lived all alone. She was very old, though she did not know it. And she was no longer the careless color of seafoam, but rather the color of snow falling on a moonlit night.
Do you like it?
I mean, I'm not very far, but I mean, how does that opening sentence not grab you by the throat?
See, I knew. See, I'll give that book to anyone. It doesn't matter if they love fantasy or not. And I knew for you, because, you know, for as much as you enjoy fantasy, I think you just enjoy good things, and you lean a little more towards the literary, which I don't even know what that means. You know, if I was forced to define like what literary is, but it is the Last Unicorn is a book of such beautiful everything, and the language has such care and joy in it that
We are, of course, talking about Pat's, I believe it says on the dust jacket, your favorite book, which is the Last Unicorn by Peter S. Beagle.
It is. It is my absolute favorite book. And the language is.
I mean, the careless color of sea foam.
Yeah.
Like, damn.
That book, I read it every year, and every year I'm afraid. I'm like, oh, it's not going to be as good as I remember. But and then I read it and I'm like, oh, it's almost like, you know, you don't sit down and read the whole Tao Te Ching. You know, you got to stop and think about that shit every couple of lines.
Right.
And that's how I feel about The Last Unicorn. Like, I read a couple of pages now and all I can do is, you know, and I stop and I'm like, I gotta think about why that sentence has that impact.
This is, I think, may come up in the conversation. If we're gonna talk about Doctor Strange a little bit, but you know, I think what you said to draw distinction. I mean, let's get out of the like literary versus genre fiction or any of that. But just the notion of like that I like good things, which is true. I do. I really enjoy good things. I love good things, and I think there's like a certain part of the dark sort of consumerist underbelly of like nerd culture, where people like a genre thing, like you like a sci-fi thing or you like a superhero thing for almost this like box ticking reasons of like, oh, I want to see that shit. I want to see that shit. I want to see that shit. Tick my boxes. I like it. Right. And that's not always good. Sometimes that's good. Maybe you like maybe those boxes got on the list because you first saw them in something that was a good piece of media like Star Wars. But just because it ticks all the boxes does not make it good. Like, what makes it good is far more than that. And I just think that's like a thing that's often, it's like a thing that's really hard to talk about and kind of like subtle and not really discussed a lot in nerd culture. But like, something is good not because it has spaceships, it's because it's a good story. And I happen to like spaceships. So if you can tell a good story and there's a spaceship in there, that's sort of like a hook for my imagination to latch onto. But like, that doesn't give you a pass to tell a shitty story or have it poorly constructed.
That's what I, you know, when I talk about like where Name of the Wind came from, you know, I talk about the fact that I read like a fantasy novel every day, pretty much, you know, from the day I could read, you know, and sometimes I would read two, you know, I did not go outdoors a lot as a child and, you know, and so, but at that age, it pretty much was like, is there a sword in it? You know, and if the answer was yeah, like, or a dragon or a wizard or some anything like that. And if the answer was yes, it's like, I'm good. Okay. You know, like spaceship. Okay. You know,
isn't a lot of the fun of the Name of the Wind books is too, is like, if you're reading those books with your little checklist in your hand, waiting to tick off the boxes, it's going to be a long wait.
It is. But you know, when I, you know, and when I was 14, that was enough. I'm like, okay, dwarf, elf, he has a bow, there's a wizard, there's a sword, ghoul. Okay, prophecy, extra bonus. Yeah, okay, let's read this book. But then, you know, you read 1,000 of them and I'm kind of like, well, you know, like what else do we got here? And then you know, and I do, I really hate the word literature because it's ill-defined and largely meaningless. But you know, what I did is I read writers who like made excellent and careful and stunning use of the language, or rather who put care into the language that they used. And that means like Shakespeare and Chaucer and Frost and Gwendolyn Brooks and, you know, and a bunch of other poets. And, you know, because I was in college at that point. And then I was like, oh, like some of this shit is falling kind of flat. But then again, other authors, you know, were not like Roger Zelazny had amazing use of the language. Neil Gaiman has amazing use of the language. Terry Pratchett is the same, except he doesn't showboat as much as some of the rest of us. But yeah, I'm so glad that you're liking it. It is an absolute diamond of a book. Do you know that son of a bitch wrote that when he was 20 years old?
He wrote a very, I mean, in the, I was like reading about the author and he wrote a really good episode of Next Generation called Sarek. Oh,
did he? Yeah. I am not surprised, it's a fan but favorite. I am pleased.
Kind of a thinky one. Not a lot of lasers.
Yeah, I believe that.
Well, so let's see. Also, did you...
interesting note.
Yes.
He wrote the original... God, I'm about to say this and now I hesitate. But I'm pretty sure he did write the original screenplay for the Bashi animated version of Lord of the Rings.
This is a huge action-packed podcast and we've got a lot of stuff to go over. Let's take care of some of the homework first. Homework item number one, World Builders is happening right now. World Builders is Pat's annual charity fundraiser for Heifer International. Do you want to say some of the like items that are up for auction and some of the cool stuff that's happening? And we'll kind of do a quick plug for that.
The big news about World Builders that we raise money for a great charity that's been around for 70 years that gives people the education, tools, and materials to take control of their own life and control their own food production and bring in revenue for themselves and their families. And that's kind of the technical way. It's like give families like a flock of chickens and then they are able to like sell eggs and eat eggs. And that sounds like a little thing, except just today in the blog, I posted up a story about a family who went from like subsistence level farming, which means like you eat what comes out of your garden and that's it. Like they had no income, you know, and then if your garden does badly, like you are hungry and you have to beg. And Heifer came in, gave them like more vegetable seeds and chickens. And now 2 years later, these people have 200 chickens, 20 pigs. They're opening their own store. Their child gets to go to school. And they have also passed along chickens to their neighbors and trained their neighbors in the use of these chickens. Like in 2 years, these people's lives have been like revolutionized. And that's what Heifer International does. They do it with livestock or honeybees or fruit trees. It's education-based, it's sustainable, and it lasts forever. It's not like a bag of rice that you're sending to a hungry person. The big news is that it's an awesome charity that I've thoroughly vetted. Second big piece of news, they can do a lot with a little. Like $20 donated will buy a family like a flock of chickens. $120 buys a goat, which provides milk. The third piece of big news is that we have $1 million worth of matching money. So if you kick in, you know, $30, it'll get matched, and $60 is enough for fruit trees or nut trees. And then these people, you know, get access to that, and they can have cash crops. Fourth piece of big news is that we're giving away like more than $100,000 of books and games and cool geeky swag. And that means we've got like a beautiful handmade, like hardwood, silver, mother of pearl inlaid tack board made by the people at Wormwood. We've got a cabin for two on the Joko cruise we're giving away. Thousands of books, a lot of them signed or limited edition or drawn in by the authors or somehow special. We've got a gaming table from Geek Chic that they've donated. For every $10 you throw into the pot, you get a chance to win all of this stuff. I think right now, if you donate like just 10 bucks, your chances of winning something are like 1 in 11.
Now, I think the reason people are actually listening to this podcast, what they want to hear about, there was some pretty big Kingkiller Chronicles news today.
Yeah, there was. There was. Is.
Are you going to make me read the news article, or do you want to say it?
You know, actually, you usually read the news article. Can you give me a link? I'll read.
I got it. So this is a tweet from Lin-Manuel Miranda. Who, now I've never heard of him, but he made a musical called Hamilton, which people like. And he said, the news, I just love the world of at Patrick Rothfuss, that's Pat, and I want to spend time figuring out how to share it with you. So this is happening, and this links to a news article. Subject line of the news article, Lin-Manuel Miranda to produce Kingkiller Chronicle film TV series adaptation. Hamilton creator Lin-Manuel Miranda will be the creative producer behind an ambitious feature film and TV series of Pat Rothfuss's fantasy book trilogy. That's a pretty loose term. The Kingkiller Chronicle, Lionsgate announced Tuesday.
Yep.
Miranda will serve as a producer and, quote, musical mastermind, and will compose original music as well as write the songs. Miranda also has an option to be involved in future stage adaptations. What? That's so cool. I didn't get that far before. Of the books as well. There's so much to unpack here. All right. So first, let's just start with the big one, which is there's a movie and a TV show, which I don't think had been previously announced at all.
About, God, you know, it might have been a year since that signal flare went up, where... And people who have listened to the podcast for a while remember San Diego Comic-Con from a year ago, where I was having all those movie meetings. And so pretty much that's where this conversation started. And then I think it was around October, we made an announcement that we'd sort of – so like from early – July of last year to October, I was talking with Lionsgate, and I kept saying, well, no. And then finally we got to, I'm like, oh, really? You really want to do this? And they really were like offering things that sounded good to me. And so we did make an announcement, you know, where we had sort of signed an option. And it wasn't just for a movie, which is something I've never – well, I'm not interested in. Name of the Wind is not movie-shaped. But movie combined with TV and video games, sort of this, you know, hybrid media, you know, something that would give the story room to breathe and be something cool, instead of kind of like what you were talking about before, which is something that just checks a bunch of like bullshit fantasy boxes. And so we started there, and we made that announcement, I think last October or November. And then, you know, and then we got into the other negotiations and contracts, and that's been eating up a ton of my life, because like I only get one shot at this in some ways, and I've got to be real careful with these rights.
You don't want to throw away your shot.
I don't want to throw away my shot. Yeah.
It's just an original phrase that I came up with to describe this. You okay over there, Pat? It sounds like when you cough, it sounds like a a gravel. It sounds like a cement truck mixing on the side of the road.
You have no idea how much better I sound now than I did a week ago. As I was going through this negotiation project, I fell in love with Hamilton, went out to see it briefly, like got to like brush up against Lin-Manuel Miranda, like went to see him backstage, you know, because like he tweeted me like way back in the day, like I actually almost exactly the time, like about a month before I went out to San Diego and had all those movie talks, you know, like he quoted Slow Regard of Silent Things on Twitter, and I saw it and I responded, but I didn't know who he was. You know, I don't do musicals. I don't do theater as a rule. I just don't, I don't follow that world. And so he quoted it and we talked a little bit and he's like, love your stuff. You know, if you ever do an adaptation, let me know. I'd love to maybe. And I was like, this is just some rando off the internet. You know, I'm like, yeah, dude, you know, cool. I'll absolutely. And my friends are like, holy shit, Brothwist, you know who this is? I'm like, yeah, he wrote like a version of Hamlet, right? So he seems cool. And then only like, it's like 8 months, 9 months later, I realize who this person is, or like how amazing they are, because I start consuming their work. And it's sort of like you realize, it's like you look back and you're like, oh, back in high school, that girl who kept coming over to my house, oh shit, she was interested in me. You know, it's like I didn't realize that this could have been a thing. But I reached out to him, and of course, in between then and when I realized it, dude had won like 14 Tony Awards. The Pulitzer had like rapped with the president, you know, just like everything has blown up for him, as it should, because dude is nonstop. And so I reached out in like the most awkward high school way. And I'm like, hey, you know, Lin, do you want to, there's some stuff is happening, you know, you want to maybe. And so we started talking, and so now, and he was interested. I still, honestly, it's a little staggering to me that somebody like him is interested in coming and being a geek for my stuff and working with me on this project.
Now tell me about the musical aspect. So obviously there is some music and some sort of musical scenes that come into play in the story. But do you imagine as this gets adapted with Lin-Manuel Miranda as a producer that it becomes more of a musical? Like Kvothe like looks into the camera and he like breaks into song to describe his like interior state?
Well, you know, I know you're kind of fucking with me there, but you know, here's the thing. Like, here's my fear. You know, in doing an adaptation, I know things are going to have to change. But then the big issue is we've all seen things that have changed for the better in adaptation, and we've all seen things that have changed for the worse. But because I am not a TV maker or a movie maker, or a into visual medium adapter or musicker, adapting my work from text into this thing, it requires like an incredible, like crazy amount of trust. Because I can be involved, but I should not be involved too much because I don't fucking know cinematography or music or any of this. So I know you were kind of kidding. It's like, is this going to be a musical? We don't know exactly what it will be. We've got a couple of pitches. We're talking about it, and I've actually got a thing here right on my desk. One of the newer concept, you know, I don't know what you call them. It's not a full screenplay, but it's what comes before. Sort of, I guess it's a pitch or a.
I don't know why you're asking me. No one can know less about this than I do.
I trust Lin, and not that I don't trust the other people, But Lin, as a fellow creator whose stuff I universally adore, if he and who has experience with adaptation, like from a real world story of Hamilton into a great musical, you know, if things ended up becoming a little more musical like, you know, I would be more relaxed with somebody like Lin involved because I trust him so much creatively. But more importantly, like, music is such a big part of the books and Quoth's life and troops, and he's always in inns and there's music.
That is one of the big challenges, is like in the book you can say he played the most beautiful song and it moved everyone to tears. And as the reader, you sort of come in and fill that in with your imagination, and maybe you substitute in, you know, the idea of music or a song that would be emotionally moving to you. But that's a very subjective, you know, you're doing a lot of performance as the reader in those moments. And I think when you pin it down to film and you have to decide, well, what does it sound like? How do you convey the sort of gravity of this moment or the song, I mean, you really do need that. It's got to be good. It's hard to fake being good.
Yeah, exactly. Like you know, it's like you can talk a lot of talk, but eventually, you know, if you're teasing, and a lot of times text is a tease. It's me getting you, like, just like you said, getting you to imagine what would be awesome for you. And once I've done that, I've succeeded with you as an audience. But on screen, we have to do one thing, you know, I can't just, it's not a burlesque anymore. Like, you know, you have to take your clothes off, and then they're going to look at you and you know, and well, if
this is the problem of classic, like, horror films, right? Like, before sort of like CGI and technology, like whenever you revealed the monster, all the air got let out because the monster inevitably looked rubbery and ridiculous, and it was never as scary as not seeing it, is how you imagined it.
Yep. Well, honestly, it's still the issue where, like, have we gone down the Stranger Things?
No, I'd be happy to talk about Stranger Things. I mean,
we'll do that in the future.
Yeah,
but
let me. I have at least a few more questions about the before we start veering off into an ADD rabbit hole.
I was going to say, even now with all of this gorgeous CGI, like, it's still an issue. Like, great CGI, but as soon as you show this beautiful CGI monster, it still loses something. But the thing is with Lin, and, you know, here, I'm going to actually compare it to, like, the weirdest adaptation, or the weirdest movie comparison ever, the second Bill and Ted movie.
Okay.
Because I'm on board. Think about it. All the way, like, leading up to, like, you know that these guys are supposed to eventually save the world with the beauty of their rock and roll music, right? And then you get to the end of the second movie, and they're going to perform a song that is the start of this worldwide revolution. These movies?
No.
Oh, shit, you're kidding me. Okay, wow, I'm dating myself probably by... And so they're up there on stage, and they've painted themselves into a corner because, like, this song has to be, like, some amazing rock and roll. And, of course, what they did is they just pulled in, like, a very good but not instantaneously recognizable to everybody rock and roll song. But even so, it couldn't help but fall flat. But Lin actually makes music that is, like, world-class, catchy, best everything. And so, that, in addition to the fact that he gets storytelling, he gets pacing, he gets adaptation, he knows how to tell the story of an arrogant, intelligent orphan boy, you know, making his way in the world. You gotta watch Moana, by the way.
I've heard nothing but great things. I'll tell you as a you know, as a fan, and also as just someone who's you know, really rooting for you here to make something that is creative, above all else, that's creatively successful. Like, I mean, we've talked so much, we've talked about this a lot on the podcast, but, like, you know, you've said often, maybe not as bluntly as this, but, like, that you'd rather make something with artistic integrity that is good and stands out on its own, even if it has even if that means sacrificing it being, like, a mega hit. Like what's important to you is that it's good at any cost, right? And I think a lot of artists, I mean, let's be honest, every artist goes into a project with that as the hope. And, you know, especially once you get into an environment where a movie studio, for example, is spending, you know, millions of dollars on this sort of property and there's all these hundreds of people working on it, every incentive is to push something towards being sort of safe and mediocre, and you file off all the edges, and anything confusing or challenging or nuanced or difficult gets sort of like filtered until it's this like smooth, expensive paste that the lowest common denominator can like, you know, hold down their gullet. And, you know, that's to some extent that's going to be inevitable because of the budget and the amount of people working on this thing. But I just know that I'm working on this. There's going to be moments of compromise where you as the creator are going to want to put your foot down and say, here's where I'm drawing the line. We're not doing that. And, you know, I do one thing that just makes me so excited about having, you know, Lin-Manuel Miranda attached to this is I think he has enough. You know, even where you don't have that sort of clout in Hollywood or the political relationships or the reputation or whatever, people will listen to him. And he I know is a fan of, loves them and will fight for your creative vision. And I think that is the ally you want, where if you're going to pick that battle and you're like, I'm dying on this hill, we're not changing this. He is the guy who you want on your side to say, artistically, this is important. Here's why it matters.
Yeah. You know, and you really hit the nail on the head there, because yeah, it's like, I will, you know, one of the other people that's involved in the project is somebody who I absolutely adore, and you would love him too. His name's John Rogers. And, you know, long before he was ever officially attached to the project, he was talking to me about Hollywood because he was a fan of the books too. And he knows the industry inside and out. And he said, here's the thing. You get one hill to die on. He goes, but you only get one hill. And he goes, so pick it. You know, pick it, but realize that you might not get two. You die on that hill. And I've always remembered that. And you're right. You know, eventually I get to put my foot down, or hopefully I get to put it down in a couple of places. But the fact is that, like, Lin-Manuel Miranda's foot is like way bigger and heavier than mine.
Right. And this is a guy who succeeded against all odds at making something, God, I hate to give this up to Hamilton, and making something really smart and provocative and different and sort of somehow. I mean, well, you know how it goes. It's like, it's nearly impossible to do that in a mass media context. Like, it's kind of incredible that anyone can do that. It's sort of this like combination of like, politics and force of will and creative vision and I don't know what it is. It's like, but he did it. I mean, you know, Hamilton stands with its integrity as his vision, and it's the most, you know, the biggest musical I think of all time now. Like, it didn't have like the biggest weekend of any Broadway show this last weekend.
I just read that, and the truth is, I went out to see to talk with him a little bit, a couple of times. That's, I've been going out to New York every once in a while, and people on the Twitters occasionally see a little picture. But you know, the day we were going out and he was going to meet with the studio and all of us and kind of listen to these pitches, you know, the day before that, was the Moana, screener that he invited me to go see Moana with a bunch of his people, and of course the day before that he was on SNL. Like, this, I mean, I cannot imagine like how his feet ever touch the ground or how he sleeps.
Look at you, you're going running to the ER for a bruised vocal cord, you baby.
Yeah, exactly. You know,
you can't get 2 weeks through a charity fundraiser without going to the ER.
I know. And I'm like, I was like, God, my voice is really bad. Who do I know that might know how to take care of a strained voice? And I'm like, I can't email Lynn and say, Lynn, I talked too much for a couple of days and my voice, like, I would shame myself in front of him, doing two shows of Hamilton for a year. What really, cause I knew that I loved him, and The Heights is great. And, you know, and then I knew he was working on Moana, and I knew that Hamilton was great, and he's so caring, and he's so loving, and he's so full of joy in his attitude towards all of these things. And all of that is something I want to be around and be involved with creatively. And I knew that he was doing the music of Moana, but then I saw Moana and it is the best Disney movie I've ever seen. You know, I will say that I've seen it twice now, and I will actually just say that I saw it. And then afterwards, like, I go up to him and, like, I have been crying at this movie. My first showing, my kids were not there. It was just me, you know, beardy 40-year-old guy crying at this Disney movie. And I went up to him and I'm like, okay, I know you get, you know, like, your family's here. It's like, I just need a minute. I go, what the hell? What the hell was going on? Like, this is amazing. And he goes, yeah, it took us a lot of time to figure that out. And I go, what do you mean? Like, were you involved in the story too? He's like, yeah. He goes, I was in there kind of. And I'm like, okay. And that was like it. That was like any remaining hesitation as to like his ability to work collaboratively and make amazing things. It's like it was at 98% before. And I'm like, oh, you weren't just like their musical ringer in this. You were also a part of this collaborative project working out the shape of this story. And I'm like, and at that point, I'm like, I went from loving him and wanting him the most to like, he was going to be my hill to die on. And I'm like, if you guys can't bring him in, just him pulling off that hat trick, The Heights and Hamilton and now Moana, and now he's shooting the new Mary Poppins in London right now. So it's weird to be a project, like the next project in that line. I mean, how fucked up is that?
Well, you have a much better story than Mary Poppins. Give us a little something that's new. Give us some news here, Pat. Tell us a little something that's not in that news article.
I don't think I'm telling stories out of school here. We sat down in the meeting, and of course everybody loved him because how can you not? But he said, I'm the fan here. He goes, I want to be president of the Don't Fuck It Up committee. He said that, and I felt the tension leave my body. I thought to myself, oh God, we need a Don't Fuck It Up committee. And I should not be the president. I will remember that for the rest of my life.
You say the price of my love's not a price that you're willing to pay. You cry in your tea, which you hurl in the sea when you see me go by. Why so sad? Remember we made an arrangement when you went away, now you're making me mad. Remember, despite our estrangement, I'm your man. You'll be back soon, you'll see. You'll remember you belong to me. You'll be back, time will tell. You'll remember that I served you well. Oceans rise. Push comes to shove, I will send a fully armed battalion to remind you of my love. La da 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 da. You say your love is draining and you can't go on. Fight and win the war for your love, for your praise, and I. comes to shove, I will kill your friends and family to remind you of my love. La da 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 da
da. I was with, so we were at this I was at this Barnes and Noble. We were at that, Holiday Hole out in the middle of nowhere, Western Illinois. And Josh, Card's co-creator Josh, was with me coming back from the Holiday Hole, and we stopped to charge the car at the Barnes & Noble. And we were going through the fantasy section looking at books, and they only had Wise Man's Fear. That was like the only book of yours they had in stock. They just had one copy. And we were started talking about it, and Josh was like, and I was like, oh, have you read these? You would really like these. And he's like, yeah. He's like, but there's no way he's finishing this story in one more book. And I was like, ooh, that hadn't occurred to me.
Oh, yeah. That gets said quite frequently. Yeah, that gets said a lot.
Any further comment or?
I can understand why people say it a lot.
It does sound, because I never really thought about it too much, because I know that it's supposed to be a trilogy, but it does kind of make sense. Like, there's a lot of narrative. We haven't gotten any king killing yet.
Oh, shit. I forgot about that. But no, it's, you know, and I'll say what I always say, you know, which is, you know, this story is a trilogy. This story has an end. There will be more stories in this world that I have created. And so, like, I mean, it's not the Lord of the Rings, because, like, at the end of the Lord of the Rings, like, everything is for real, fucking, like over. Like, the world is used up at the end of the Lord of the Rings. All the elves are, like, it's not just that their stories, like, they're all just, everybody's gone. No more magic. No more ring, no more evil, you know, everybody's either dead or gone to the West, you know, and, you know, that's not the story I'm telling. You know, I'm telling a person's story. And once that story is done, there will be more in this world and more with these characters.
Yeah, I, you know, there's this amazing quote that I, think about all the time from, I hope I haven't read this on the podcast already, but it's from George R. R. Martin. And it was from this like long interview he did with Rolling Stone. And he was talking about Lord of the Rings and how a lot of the Game of Thrones books are, Fire and Ice books are sort of his sort of political response in a way to the ending of Lord of the Rings. So he said about Tolkien's portrayal of power in Lord of the Rings, he said, as George R. R. Martin said, "Ruling is hard. This was maybe my answer to Tolkien, whom, as much as I admire him, I do quibble with. Lord of the Rings had a very medieval philosophy that if the king was a good man, the land would prosper. We look at real history, and it's not that simple. Tolkien can say that Aragorn became king and reigned for 100 years, and he was wise and good. But Tolkien doesn't ask the question, what was Aragorn's tax policy? Did he maintain a standing army? What did he do in times of flood and famine? And what about all those orcs? By the end of the war, Sauron is gone, but all of the orcs aren't gone. They're in the mountains. Did Aragorn pursue a policy of systematic genocide and kill them, even the little baby orcs in their little orc cradles?" Like, that's such a great, it's such a great little thought of, like, you know, it draws such a great contrast between this, you know, an older generation of, you know, genre fiction and a more current version of genre fiction. And it's something I love about the Fire and Ice books. It's something I love about your books, is like, this world is so textured. Like, you can really, you know, you don't get the feeling that the world goes away at the end of the story.
Yeah. And truthfully, I mean, you feel, I felt the same way about The Lord of the Rings. I mean, this world is exhausted and changed and fading at the end of The Lord of the Rings, but it is hugely still extant, you know, like it is still real and there. I almost think of them as, you know, and here I'm going to just make a mess by wandering an art form I know nothing about, but, you know, like Tolkien, you could almost view it as like a Monet, you know, like where it's, you can't look at that and go, you know, you don't know anything about anatomy, you know, mm-hmm. you know, it's like, where's your concept of perspective? Mm-hmm. Because that's not the game he was playing. You know, Tolkien was doing like these bold lines, this like literally that's where probably where the term epic fantasy comes from, because Tolkien was basing this stuff on the actual epics, you know, these old Eddas where it's like, and you charged out from the hills and there was a lot of cleaving and rending in twain and big magic and thunder and lightning and then the death of a hero and all fades and then it's like an opera. But, you know, and that's great, but it's different than Downton Abbey, you know? I'm trying to think. I switched from painting to opera to a TV show. I think that's my hat trick right there for mingled metaphor. Mm-hmm. And obviously Martin is telling a whole different sort of story. It's almost more like, and they're like, well, you know, more like a woodcut almost. It's like, it's rough.
I would say Lord of the Rings is more of like OK Computer and Name of the Wind is more of like a Kid A.
Boy, I don't understand any of those words.
Yeah, neither do I.
are those art people?
Sure. Well, our homework this week was to not think about United States President-elect Donald Trump. Ugh. And my stomach just turned over. Our homework was to go see Doctor Strange. So Veronica and I went and saw, we actually saw two movies this weekend. We saw Doctor Strange and we saw Arrival. Have you seen Arrival at all?
I have not, but you said that it was good.
So we'll talk about Arrival on a later podcast because I'm happy to talk about Doctor Strange. I'm like, particularly it, just seeing those back to back, it like draws such a clear contrast one type of science fiction versus another type of science fiction or something like that. Arrival is, I think it's, do not watch the trailer. I think it's best if you know almost nothing about it and just go see it and know that it's this really beautiful sort of small sci-fi film. It's very slow. It's really beautifully paced, beautiful performances, beautiful cinematography, and you're just going to go and sort of have this weird, suspenseful, fascinating experience that you'll think about for like weeks afterwards.
Cool. I'm in. As soon as you said it was good, I thought, great, that will be, I might actually go with my lady friend and watch a movie.
It was awesome. It was so good. It's my favorite sci-fi film I've seen in some time. But anyway, this week we'll talk about Doctor Strange. I think safe to say spoilers for Doctor Strange. I don't want to be too – I mean, I don't know that like – I don't even know that you really can spoil that movie too much. But
yeah, I don't think there's much to spoil.
What did you think?
I think it was a – I should maybe explain my background here. I never read comics as a kid, at least not like a lot of kids did, but I did read some comics. You know, there was a big box of like loose single issues at my library. And so you could go and like dig through them and actually check out comic books. And there were only two comic books that I read. And one of them was Green Lantern, which, again, keep in mind, I'm reading a bunch of random loose issues. So like no order. If there were storylines back then, I don't know what they were. And I read Green Lantern and I read Doctor Strange. So I do have like a little bit of nostalgia there, but it's very dim and distant. But that said, like the Doctor Strange was pretty badass in my head, you know, like it, that was, if I was going to be somebody, I didn't want to be Superman. I want to be fucking Doctor Strange. But yeah, I think it was a, it was a good action movie.
I was engaged the whole time. I certainly did not think it was boring. I felt that it was, you know, so you're looking, it's a superhero origins. It's a Marvel, you know, what's that guy who's in charge of the Marvel Cinematic Universe that like basically makes all these movies, the producer, that guy, it's like his sort of template.
Is it Jesus?
Jesus, yeah, Marvel Jesus.
Marvel it's, Jesus.
It's the, it, there's some guy whose name I can't remember, and he's the, you know, the mastermind behind the Marvel sort of cinematic movie. And I think they've, you know, clearly Marvel's tapped into something, which is like people love the sort of all story, the sort of like hero's journey, you know, story circle. And they will keep doing that story circle with a slightly different twist. I mean, you know the story circle I'm talking about, right?
Is this the Joseph Campbell?
Yeah. It's the Joseph Campbell story circle. But yeah, it's this, you know, this idea of like the hero's origin story. And this is a very pleasing, you know, for a lot of reasons. It's very extremely pleasing sort of shape of a story for like for the human mind. And it's very sort of successful, and you kind of can rehearse the beats in your head while you're asleep, and you kind of know there's a sort of comfort to it of like, okay, we're in the second act and the stakes are going to get raised to save the world and sacrifice something. Like, it's like you kind of know exactly where you're going the whole time, and then the fun is like the little twists and turns they throw in. So I liked it. I had my quibble, and oh, and it was beautiful. It was like a really cool looking movie. It looked really expensive. Like, the set pieces were cool. I liked the sort of like psychedelic clockwork battle scenes. I thought that was all, you know, like very competently, nicely done.
Yeah, I think the effects were very well accomplished. Yeah.
Yeah, but that being said, like I wasn't blown away by it. I haven't been blown away by a Marvel movie. Maybe I just recently watched the like Captain America films, and I felt that, I think the first Captain America movie I was pretty blown away by, and that's a movie that really really busts out of that, as much as a Marvel movie does, really busts out of that story circle. But yeah, let's see. I mean, I'll say like one of my biggest gripes about the film was, so I feel that it sort of took a lot of this, I don't know, like Eastern mysticism, wisdom of the Orient, kind of Orientalist philosophy, you know, like fortune cookie wisdom, and it sort of reduced it into this sort of meaningless superhero gobbledygook. And the only reason it bugged me, because that happens all the time in film, the only reason it sort of got under my skin was, so the Benedict Cumberbatch is the main guy, and he's this doctor, and he's this sort of like sciencey, like grizzled, skeptic kind of a guy. And he goes to Tilda Swinton, and she's the wise guru, and Cumberbatch says, I'm just a physicalist and a materialist, and all that there is physical matter and the laws of physics, and we die and that's the end, and we're just these tiny insignificant specks. And she goes, no, that's not true. There actually is a higher, you know, there is all this mysticism and this higher purpose, and you can put on this magic ring and travel into other dimensions and fight wizards and become a sorcerer and all of that. And you know, the, you're like, okay, cool. Like, this guy's...
You're a wizard, Harry.
You're a wizard, Benedict Cumberbatch. yeah, you know, and he, like, finds his purpose battling the giant testicle monster at the end, the evil testicle monster. But, you know, leaving the theater, I was sort of thinking about this, and I was like, you know, just turning it over my head, and I was like, boy, I felt that he, in the first act, I thought he made a pretty compelling case for this, like, sort of, like, bleak, nihilistic, materialist universe where we're sort of meaningless and we just die, and, you know, all there is what you see. And in my life, it's not actually an option for me to go turn into a sorcerer and fight evil in other dimensions. So where does that leave me? Like, what else do you got?
Well, Max, have you been to the Orient? Because that's where they do that.
Do you know what I'm saying? It's like these superhero movies. I mean, they're in some sense, they're like the worst kind of like smart dumb, where it's like you feel like you're going to be like, you know, it's this important art that sort of takes itself seriously, has a certain gravitas, and like the it's very deliberate filmmaking, and you're meant to sort of be really sucked into this thing and engaged by it, and it's not nourishing. Like, it leaves you with nothing. It's like, I'd feel like I it's like eating, filling up yourself up with candy. It's like, well, it's like I'm not hungry anymore, but I've received no nutritional benefit from this meal.
No, what's, you know, I'm going to make a, here's, this is my day for weird comparisons. Give it, like, I will agree, it was very much like a coat of sparkly wisdom looking paint over not much substance. I would say there was more legitimate philosophical wisdom in Kung Fu Panda 3. which sounds like such a bitchy thing to say, like, oh, wow, Rothfuss, that's, you're throwing some shade there. No, it's actually that, like, I watched Kung Fu Panda 3, and, like, the things that wise people say in Kung Fu Panda 3, I listen, and I'm like, holy shit, that is actually legitimately good life advice, well articulated in a way that anyone can understand it. You know, whereas you're right, in Doctor Strange, it's like, and they're both action movies and they're both popcorny, but, you know, it says a little bit that Kung Fu Panda 3 paid in terms of like nutritive, thought in a way that Doctor Strange, did not. But I do agree where, would I have liked to see more of that? Yeah, you know, I would have. I feel like it was a solid B. You know, I was not pissed.
It, you know what? It went down easy.
Yeah, it went down easy. I went in. I like looking at Benedict Cumberbatch.
Why did he have a bad American accent?
And I was just about to bring up the accent. You know, I think it was. I didn't think it was particularly bad. Except I did occasionally notice it, which probably means it was at least a little bit bad.
Why? I just don't understand. Like, he has one of the most iconic great voices in all of the world. Why? Just let him talk. Like, I don't get it.
It was a weird choice. Because, I mean, especially because, like, nobody's going to go, oh, no, a wizard, but he's British wizard. Like, yeah. Holy thousands.
Now that's
that,
where I, that's
you know?
Where I draw the line. Yeah, I can't believe that.
It's too far.
Yeah.
Too far. But, you know, and in some ways, you know, to be fair, I will give them half a nod toward, you know, sticking to the original material, because he's totally American. You know, Doctor Strange is, you know, that's in some ways part of his journey. And I suppose, you know, if you're going to think of Sherlock Holmes as, you know, and I've had this argument with friends, like, is Sherlock Holmes of necessity in all of his incarnations, does he need to be British? You know, could you have
certainly not, because a house is the best ever incarnation of Sherlock Holmes. And that's very American.
Well, see, that's just it. But then, is he Sherlock Holmes, or is he merely Holmesian, or is he merely a detective? You know,
it's such an elevation of the Sherlock Holmes of the essential structure of Sherlock Holmes. It's the highest form that story's ever been told in my opinion.
Interesting. I've never actually watched it.
House is a wonderful. I mean, I recommend because it's not a serialized, right? Yeah, it's not serialized. You can just sort of jump around, and I recommend like get like a best of episodes of House, but because House has a lot of like weird filler or like very special episodes, but the peaks of House are like some of the best television ever. Like it's kind of trashy, but It the highest highs of House are just incredible.
That's Hugh Laurie, right?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah,
that's kind of his like breakout American role.
Yeah, dude is a fucking actor. But yeah, you know, for me, I do feel, you know, and I a lot of times when I try to think critically about a movie, which I do not do very much, I either it's like I enjoy it or I bitch about it in narrative terms, rarely in terms of movie. You know, but I go back to what either Siskel or Ebert said, where, you know, three good scenes and no bad scenes is what he wanted.
Right.
And, you know, and I think of Doctor Strange and I go, I like Cumberbatch. The fights were engaging and clever.
I liked the story resolution at the end with the sort of time travel-y thing in the testicle universe. I felt that they could have earned it a little bit more narratively by setting up. I felt like they could have laid the groundwork for that so that it was actually a little more clever. But nonetheless, I thought it was good. I thought it was smart. A nice smart ending that wasn't just people punching each other.
That was smart and that was different. Not A plus smart, but I'll take B smart. And that's pretty much how I felt about the whole thing. I'm like, oh, action, solid B. And you got to work for a B. B's a good grade. Acting, solid B. Like dialogue, you know, there's some clever bits. Didn't wow me all the time. B, you know, it's like every B, B, B across the board, which, you know, might seem, again, critical to a lot of people, but those people would have never taken one of my classes and realized how fucking hard you get a B out of Rothfuss. You get a B out of Rothfuss, you know you've done some fucking work.
There's no grade inflation in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I have a pretty big nit to pick with this film that it used one of my least favorite tropes in all of storytelling. Which is, I believe, if you go on TV Tropes, it's called the smartest guy in the room. And so this is a trope where there's a character. This is sort of a common trope in media where there's a character who sort of has all the knowledge, and they're the smartest guy in the room. Now, when this is executed, it is actually like my favorite TV trope. I'm such a sucker for this. And some examples of media where I feel that the smartest guy in the room trope is executed extremely well. It would be, let's see, Dumbledore in Harry Potter. Dumbledore is the smartest guy in the room. He always is supposed to be the smartest guy. He has all the answers. And in the way that he's written, it's very believable. You really love hearing him talk, and he says these sort of profound things. Martin Sheen in The West Wing, President Bartlett, is the smartest guy in the room. He always has the solution. He always is gets the one up on everyone, and he's just a delight to watch on screen. In this film, the Tilda Swinton character was very clearly written to be the smartest guy in the room, and it fell so flat. I mean, nothing drives me crazier than when someone tries to write a smartest guy in the room, but they themselves. But here's the thing with writing that is, as the author, yourself be extremely smart, because if you're not, and if you're not capable of writing extremely smart, profound, witty dialogue, you will have the most shallow, pathetic, like. Character, sort of embarrassing character that you can put to page. And the Tilda Swinton character, I felt like she offered pseudo profundity, and nothing she did made any sense. And it just, the trope fell so flat, and I felt, you know, it leaves me with this feeling of being like insulted.
You know, I will agree with you on that. I will agree. And I think if looking at the movie, if there is a failing that I was going to pick, it probably would be, because like, people, I think part of it is, it's not that I don't like that actress, because I think she plays to that type very well, or to that character very well, which is why the only reason I know who she is because she kind of has a look and she gets put into these characters. I think, she came in as like Gabriel or like the Metatron or something, because she has kind of this unearthly look.
Yeah, it wasn't an issue with the performance, right? Because she had so much gravitas, and like, you really do take her seriously. And the problem is, the longer that you hear her talk, the more you're like, this is just a bunch of like Wesley Crusher technobabble bullshit that they're spouting at me that means nothing. And it's not actually smart writing. She's not actually saying anything smart. And the whole implication that I'm supposed to be like blown away by the brilliance of this character, it just sort of is like something about it is like, it's like seeing the boom mic come into the shot of like, all right, I get it. I'm watching this dumb action movie.
I could say two things. One, it could have been worse very easily. From a couple of different angles. They did not play her as the secret baddie. you know?
They sort of did, though.
Well, a little bit, but not in cliche way.
It's ambiguous.
Yeah, it's ambiguous. But the other part of it is, like, they could have, it would have been a double or nothing situation if they'd turned this into the perils of compromise and the price of power. You know, like, what if they had tried to turn that into the theme of things? You know, like, that could have really added a lot of substance to this. Like, here is a person who, like, in order to keep, you know, to like keep the torch lit and the flame of knowledge of these arts burn, has compromised, and eventually there are consequences. And I'm like, that, you know, but that would have been really hard to successfully interleave with this particular, you know, with a kind of a fun Cumberbatch magic-y action up movie,
right?
You know, oh shit, Max, hey, I'm trending on Twitter.
All right.